Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
A few years ago, in a widely noted essay, William Dershowitz, then of Yale, warned that the nation's top colleges were turning our kids into zombies. Now, while Dershowitz noted that many of his students at Yale were, in his words, bright, thoughtful, and creative kids, most of them seemed content to color within the lines. Very few, he says, were passionate about ideas. Very few saw college as part of an intellectual discovery. Everyone dressed, he said, as if they were ready to be interviewed at a moment's notice. Now, I know Yalies are sad because they're not at NYU, and so naturally they're quite upset. But I wonder if you might recognize something in Dershowitz's own description of students. Driven, accomplished, talented, disciplined, successful, and capable. I suspect you do, or at least you'd like to think that you recognize those descriptions. And yet, as described by Dershowitz, if you looked beneath the facade of seamless well-adjustment, what you'll often find, he says, are toxic levels of fear, anxiety, emptiness, aimlessness, and isolation. And in his phrase, the prospect of not being successful terrified them more than anything else. Or as Mark Schiffman, who was then professor of humanities at Villanova, once termed it, contemporary students are not majoring in physics or neuroscience, they're majoring in fear. As he puts it, Hunger Games should be the novel of the generation. Because Hunger Games depicts adolescents rigorously trained by adults for desperate but meaningless life or death competitions. They're all honed up with no place to go, he said. And so afflicted with a desperate compulsion for competitive advantage, students rack up, this is still Schiffman, majors and minors and certificates and credentials and internships to keep them in the running for what they fear to be an ever more elusive success. They're driven by fear. Now, I hesitate to say it, but perhaps if any of that sounds true to you, if any of those descriptions sound right, that there's something missing, that maybe this is not quite how things ought to be. And note, it seems to me that they're describing not merely the life of college students in the United States, but really the lives of a lot of Americans. Hurried, hasty, anxious, and uncertain of their purpose. Students, it seems to me, are mirroring their parents, their teachers, their mentors. For many of us are like this now. That is, we're not entirely sure what we're for, since we're not entirely sure what the purpose of life is. We're not so sure what would make for a life well lived, and so instead we opt for accomplishment and success and the racking up of awards. We're not so sure what it is to be well, and so we settle for doing well as a replacement. If I have the award, I must be pretty okay, right? Now, perhaps somewhat counterintuitively, I suggest for your reflection that part of this frenzy, I should ask, do any of you feel frenzied in your work at university and in the city? Does it feel like you're racking up credentials and majors and minors and certificates and internships? Anyone feel a bit of a frenzy? Okay, good. Well, no, not good, but I'm glad my description isn't entirely false. It seems somewhat counterintuitive, but this description could be what some earlier thinkers referred to as sloth or sloth. Now, the word sloth to us, I suspect, implies laziness, and laziness is hardly the problem just described. If anything, it's a frenzied busyness that describes us, not laziness. But at the same time, patristic and medieval thinkers didn't by sloth or achadia, some of you classicists will snivel and say it's Acadia, but I just go with achadia. They don't mean so much by this laziness, but something more like a lack of magnanimity. A failure to desire and will the fullness of the good. So rather than being magnanimous or great-souled, what I want to explore tonight is the idea that we would rather be free. Rather than magnanimous or great-souled, we'd rather be free, and that's sloth. Now, let me explain a bit what I mean, starting with the fiction of Cormac McCarthy. Some of you probably know Cormac McCarthy, maybe for No Country for Old Men or The Road, his most famous works. And if you've read him, you know that they're apocalyptic. There's a lot of violence and they're pretty grim. But of all of his terrors, I know of none more awful than the character of Judge Holden in the novel Blood Meridian or The Evening Redness in the West. which is a somewhat fictional accounting of John Joel Glanton's gang of bounty hunters who slaughter, desecrate, and kill all their way across the Southwest. In the novel, brutality pervades, or in the words of the book, war endures, grinding everything into oblivion before the ultimate trade of death. Now, early in the novelist, the protagonist, nameless throughout, identified only as the Kid, runs away from his drunken father, and he joins Captain Glanton to hunt Apache. They're getting bounties for killing Apache. And it turns out it doesn't much matter who they kill. As long as they bring in a scalp, they get a bounty. So they kill everyone they come across. Now, while Glanton is the formal leader, it's another member of the gang, so-called Judge Holden, who is the sort of worst in the novel. He's described as a perverse Moses leading his people through the American deserts. He's horrible. He collects children and discards them to die in the desert. He leads children around on leashes and leads them to die in the desert. But his history is quite strange. He appears unannounced in the desert. He's just sitting on a rock. They don't know where he came from, and he leads them in a kind of salvific mood. He provides gunpowder from raw materials for them. But his whole history is quite strange. He doesn't seem to have a past at all. He's unencumbered by tradition or history. At one point, the gang returns to Chihuahua to receive payment for their trophies of war. And as each goes into the public baths to wash away the gory remnants of their exploits, they descend, this is McCarthy, one by one into the waters, all tattooed and branded and sutured, deformed, fingers missing, eyes, their foreheads and arms stamped with letters and numbers, as if they were articles requiring inventory. Each and every member of the gang bears in their body a history in some visible fashion, a tattoo, a scar, a criminal's brand, except for the judge. Not only is he described as being strangely childlike and completely hairless, but as he disrobes to enter into the thin gruel of blood and filth, he reveals no marks at all. No scars, nothing. No traces of past history. He's bare and pink, baby-like. He is, he says, not compelled by history. He is always judged, never judged. Now, despite lacking history, he is nonetheless portrayed as being the most educated man in the territory. He has knowledge of geology, geography, natural history. You've read the novel. Is my description on so far? All right. He's awful, isn't he? He knows natural history, myth, literature, languages. He discourses eloquently on a variety of subjects, and his authority over his interlocutors is absolute. Now, here's where it gets interesting. He carries a notebook in which he sketches plant and animal life, geological finds, even artifacts from earlier cultures. But oddly, after he sketches them in his notebook, for instance, after sketching some ancient cave drawings, he scratches the originals off the wall of the cave. Another time, he sketches various pieces of armor and weaponry left centuries before by the Spanish, and then destroys the artifacts. Here's how McCarthy describes it. He, the judge, took up the little foot guard and turned it in his hand and studied again, and then crushed it into a ball of foil and pitched it into the fire. He gathered up the other artifacts and cast them into the fire as well. And he seemed much satisfied with the world, as if his counsel had been sought at the day of creation. For the judge, knowledge is a kind of hunt. He captures reality in his notes and then snuffs out its being. For him, all being, personal and impersonal, is treated this way, as something to possess and then discard. At one point, he's asked why he does this, and he says that any reality not under his direct control is an offense. Here's what he says. Whatever exists, whatever in creation exists without my knowledge exists without my consent. These anonymous creatures may seem like little or nothing in the world, yet the smallest crumb can devour us, any smallest thing beyond the rock outside of man's knowing. Only nature can enslave man, and only when the last existence of every last entity is routed out and made to stand naked before him will he properly be suzerain of the earth. None of his interlocutors know what a suzerain is, and he defines it for them. He says it's a special kind of ruler, one who rules even when there are other rulers, one whose authority countermands other judgments. In other words, the judge's authority is such that no autonomy of others is permitted. Nothing, he says, may be permitted to occur save by my dispensation, even if that means molesting everything under his rule. The freedom of birds, he describes, as an insult. Now, here's what I want to suggest. Judge Holden is a striking, if somewhat overdone, symbol of the refusal of responsibility, Now, by that, I don't mean merely a shirking or a neglect. We all know the kind of irresponsibility which just doesn't attend to our labors. But rather, it's the kind of responsibility that refuses to accept each, what Romano Guardini calls, each being what it is. The judge refuses to accept being. He sees all being as a challenge to his sovereignty and a truth resisting his power. That's what I want to suggest sloth is. Not laziness, but a repugnance at being and an inordinate love of our own freedom. I'm going to use two authorities on this. The first is a 4th century Egyptian monk, Evagrius of Ponticus, to describe one form of sloth. And the second is the medieval thinker Thomas Aquinas for the Thomistic Institute. It's obligatory, I believe. In its first, I'm going to say there's two forms of sloth, both of which we can see in Judge Hall. In its first form, sloth is a hatred of responsibility, a hatred of responsibility. Achadia, sometimes called the noonday demon, is called that since it tends to strike in the tedium of the afternoon, and it receives a surprising amount of attention in the early monastic literature. Evagrius describes it, of all the vices, as the most troublesome of the temptations. If you think all of the vices, I suspect you don't think of sloth as being the most troublesome. But the noonday demon is, and here's how he describes it. I want you to imagine being in the library or at your desk or at your computer at 3:30 on a Thursday. Okay? 3:30. He causes the monk, that's you, continuously to look at the windows and forces him to step out of his cell and to gaze at the sun to see how far it is from the ninth hour and to look around here and there, whether any of his brethren are near. Moreover, the demon sends him hatred against the place, against life itself, and against the work of his hands. Now, you don't step outside to look at the sun. This is New York, but this is what you do. Yes? You've had this experience. It's 3:30 on a Thursday. You have a problem set. You're beginning to hate the work of your hands. You're beginning to hate NYU. You're beginning to hate even life itself. So what do? Well, you check to see if you exist. You do. Back to your work, yes? What do you do 20 seconds later? Well, that was just my email. What does WhatsApp say? Oh. You put it down. You check again. I don't know, none of you use Facebook anymore. You check Instagram, you check whatever. You check whatever you check, yes? Now, remember, what time did we start? 3:15, was it, or 3:30? Let's go with 3:30. What time is it now that you've checked your phone 12 times? What time is it now? 3:32. Any of you had this experience? Now, at 3:32, after checking Reels, TikTok, your email, WhatsApp, everything, and it's 3:32, describe for me how you feel about the work present in front of you. I'd like to hear a description. How does the work seem just at that moment? Unappealing, very mildly put. Anybody have another description? It's unappealing.
Meaningless.
Distraction. The work seems like distraction. No. This is the distraction. The work's not the distraction. You're distracted. Isn't that funny? You think of the work as distraction?
Boring.
Pointless. Why are you doing it? To rack up majors and minors and credentials and internships and a career, yes? Do you have the sense of the distaste at the place, the work of your hands, and even life itself? At 3:35, does life seem almost unendurable to you? That's sloth. Now, sloth is not laziness. That's not how it's described by Evagrius. Note, the monk is popping out, looking here and there. He's checking the sun. He's looking out the window. He even distracts himself with busyness. He engages in acts of charity. He runs around to other monks to make sure they have water and food. He takes care of other monks. He engages in good social activity. Except, what's he supposed to be doing? His prayers. So he's doing everything other than the work that are at his hands. In sloth, one commentator says, we abhor what is there and we fantasize about what is not. Do any of you have a go-to random magazine that you check when you begin to abhor what is not? Any of you check the sports scores? A bridal magazine? I always read The Guardian when I'm in the middle of sloth. Right? I got to check the British papers. I need to know what's happening in Britain. So in sloth, we abhor what is there. We abhor what is. Now note, what are we abhorring? Limits, place, being, and responsibility. What we hate is the task at hand that God has given us to do. So rather than lazing about, the slothful are often in a frenzy of activity. Now this, now that, in their disgust of the work of attentive watching over given to them at that moment. More than indolence, sloth rejects the burden of order. It chooses instead the lightness of freedom. It loves self and autonomy more than it loves the good of the work presented to them. Sloth refuses the weight of responsible living in an ordered creation. Now, of course, like the judge, the sloth will find reality bereft of meaning. Without a truth to tend, the work is boring, the work is distracting, the work is pointless. So it's bereft of meaning. At that moment, for the slothful, the world appears empty. The work seems pointless, and our roving gaze finds nothing solid upon which to rest, nothing true to serve. And so everything seems arbitrary, oppressive, and even offensive to our freedom, as something to be scratched out and broken and mastered. Lars Svensson explains the experience of freedom in such a desert of meaning. Here's how he puts it. The pell-mell rush for diversions, yes, indicates the emptiness that we feel surround us. This rush, the demand for satisfaction and the lack of satisfaction are intrinsically intertwined. The more strongly individual life becomes the center of focus, the stronger the insistence on meaning among the trivialities of everyday life. Everyday life will appear to be a prison. Everyday life is a prison. Sounds very much like the slothful monk who has hatred against his place, his cell, and his prayers, who gazes constantly out the window, hoping for something else. That's sloth in its first form, hatred of the responsibility that you have just now. Now, if you believe, as I do, that God gives all things, or at least permits all things, it implies that the work in front of you just now, that problem set, is a gift that God has allowed for you to have. And if you view it with repugnance, well, that's the vice of sloth. Now, sloth in its second form, sadness. While Evagrius articulates sloth as a hatred of responsibility, Thomas Aquinas explains Achaetia as a sadness at the divine good, a sadness at the divine good, and an aversion to acting. As he explains, the ultimate good at which sloth feels sorrow is communion with God. Or, if you want to have that less theologically, a sadness at the idea of union and commitment. Now, that's very strange, since on Thomas's account at least, communion with God is our ultimate happiness and joy. Sloth, thus, is a rejection of our own happiness. It's a distaste for our own happiness. It is, he says, sadness at the divine good about which charity rejoices. But think about the psychology of that. Why would anyone feel disgust at the possibility of their own fulfillment and happiness? We are by nature desirous of happiness. Why would we feel disgust at happiness, or even a loathing at our own good? This amounts to a refusal of being happy. Now, that's odd psychologically, but it's not unusual, it seems. Sloth, according to the commentators, rejects friendship with God, which is our happiness, because of the burdens of commitment that friendship with God entails and implies. Because friendship with God implies a concomitant transformation of the self. If we have an inordinate love of freedom, one would be saddened at the costs of friendship with God, because we would think our happiness, friendship with God, is contrary to the desires of our actual self. Now, bracket God if you want. Consider friendship just more broadly. Or consider a commitment to a tradition or a community or all the entanglements of life. One commentator puts it this way. Think if you recognize this. Think about friendship. There is not only an investment of time in friendship, but there's an investment of self that is required for the relationship. And further, for that relationship to flourish. Even more difficult are the accommodations of identity. From the perspective of the individual, freedom to be in this relationship will change me, and it will cost me. When I was a junior in college, I very unwisely came back after a summer and broke up with my then girlfriend, like the first day back after the summer holidays. We broke up. When she said why, I said, I need to be free. And I had some, you know, I was going to move to Alaska and like do things in Alaska. And she told me that was dumb and I wasn't allowed to do that. And we've celebrated 26 years of marriage, which was good. It was nice. She actually told me, that's too dumb for you to do. You're not going to ever move to Alaska. And I was like, okay. And now we're married for 26 years. And we have five children and a life together. But think about that resistance that you encounter sometimes of not wanting to commit to a friend or not wanting to commit to a marriage. I have five kids. One of them came into the bedroom last night at like 1:30 in the morning. I had woken up at 12:30 with a really scary nightmare where all my teeth were falling out and I had just fallen back asleep. I didn't want to be in a relationship with my 9-year-old at that moment. I wanted her to go away because I wanted comfort and security and sleep. I was sad that she was there. Sorry, Mahali, don't listen to this. I love you. But I was sad at 1:30 in the morning that she was there. Now, Aquinas also says that this form of sloth gives us an aversion to acting. It renders us incapable of genuine action. Again, think about friendship. If you're willing to enter into a friendship and you give up some of yourself and some of your freedom, yeah, you act in seeking the friendship. Romance is a lot like this. People refrain from romance or love because they don't wish to transform, and so they don't act. They stay in that situationship forever. Now, how so? How does it lead to an aversion for acting? Now, answering that question, how it leads to an aversion for acting, requires grasping who and what we are as persons. Now, I'd suggest first and foremost that we are desiring and loving creatures. We're not first and foremost thinking animals. We desire, I'm against Descartes on this one. I'll choose Augustine over Descartes if I have to. We desire, and all of our actions reveal our soul's thirst. Our hearts are restless until they rest in God, Augustine tells us. Now, in a way that we do not always explicitly understand, we are reaching out beyond ourselves in a self-transcending reach to what we think will be good or true or beautiful or satisfying or fulfilling. And because we are reaching for God, we reach far beyond what we can grasp. There is an unquenchable longing in the human heart for more, for fullness, for the ultimate. We have a natural desire for God. Now, particular desires, not for God, but for this or that satisfaction, this or that distraction, this or that entertainment, that while those can be very fine things, they can never exhaust the fundamental horizon of our desire. It just can't do it. Imagine, now for a moment, imagine that you're in sloth and you don't want God. You don't want to reach for communion with God. What kinds of desires would remain? And what meaning would they have? If there was no ultimate and overarching reach for what was truly good, truly beautiful, truly fulfilling, truly simple and ultimate in itself, pure act, from age to age the same. How long can the goods of money or reputation or success or accomplishment satisfy? In the end, we know, do we not, that they are somewhat irrelevant, that we are, if we're smart, somewhat actually indifferent to their allure, realizing that while they may be good, they cannot satisfy the heart's deepest longing. In other words, if we didn't reach for the ultimate good, our actions would have no purpose in and of themselves. Now, it seems to me then that you have to imagine floating through space with no horizon, right? So God is our horizon, we're reaching for God. Imagine there is no horizon. There's no left, there's no right, there's no up, there's no down, there's no near, there's no far. Why would you reach for anything in particular? When we reach for things in a rational fashion, we think of them either as instruments to some better good, or we think of them as an intrinsic good sought for its own sake. The intrinsic good sought for their own sake give us a reason for acting, yes? If we don't think there is an ultimate reason for acting, why reach for the instrumental goods? We're well aware that they're only instrumental, yes? Like imagine wanting money for its own sake. We know that money is an instrument. It's very useful to us. Imagine wanting money for its own sake and not because you're like a coin collector who understands the value of, you know, the 1922 silver buffalo or whatever. None of us just sort of play with money because it's so exciting. We want it for what it serves. Imagine if it served nothing. Doesn't that sound like the frenzied, harried, bored, distracting pointlessness that we were all sort of nodding along to before? Now, if that's the case, then acedia leaves us with a profound withdrawal into ourself. action is no longer perceived as a gift of ourself. It is instead seen as an uninhibited seeking of personal satisfaction, a desire to save our freedom at any price, all of which reveals a deeper enslavement to ourself. Now, if those two descriptions are right, a hatred of responsibility and a sadness at the divine good with a concomitant aversion to acting, then Judge Haldon, despite his overwrought description, is slothful. First, he has no gratitude for the gift of being and his responsibility to the gift of being. And second, he views commitment to any good external to him as a danger and threat to his freedom. Now, what about us? Is it possible, I suggest to you that it is, be interested to hear your thoughts, that sloth might in fact be the vice of our own time? That sloth is not just my private vice, like I have my private vices, I'm not going to talk about them, I'm going to talk about the public vices that we all share. Is it possible that sloth is not merely RJ's private vice or Lillian's possible private vice, but is the vice of the time? That Judge Haldon, remember how I described him before as a perverse Moses leading the people through the desert? That he really is leading us on our way to a pointless and slothful activity. Is sloth our great temptation or our terrible covenant? I want to suggest that it is. I think it's very easy for us to consider the world not as the gift of being and the gift of God, but as what Martin Heidegger calls a world of standing reserve. The world is just an undifferentiated set of resources for us, something to use. Rather than viewing the world as having the status of creatures full of weight and integrity, gifts of God created in the likeness of God and people created in the image of God, we tend to view others, meaning people or other creatures who are not persons, as standing at attention before our desires. There to satisfy us. Could anything be more descriptive than that, than the epidemic of pornography in the West? Others are there standing at attention to satisfy our desires without any responsibility of our gift to them. Things we view are under our judgment, waiting to be captured in our notebook and then cast aside. If we are not bound by the things, but they're bound by our will, what limits our use of these things other than our own will, our own whimsy? Now, in what way can our desires be so ordered so as to respect the integrity of things, when their meaning of things is determined by how they satisfy us? When misunderstood autonomy governs our life, this like fervent commitment to independence, it's inevitable as well that all human relations are going to become competitive, because you are going to be a danger to my unchecked sovereignty. I wish to be suzerain, you wish to be suzerain, and now we are in a condition of war of all against all, are we not? Now, not only against the physical world, but to everyone, everything we're going to view as being bleached out at its integrity. The resistance of everything is an affront. The freedom of birds, if it doesn't satisfy us, is an affront. All that remains for us is power. Here's how Michael Hanby describes it. Such a culture, he means ours, assumes that our lives are innately and intrinsically meaningless without the constant stream of dissimulation and distraction. I'm going to read that line again. You tell me if that rings true to the average citizen resident of New York circa 2025. Our lives are innately and intrinsically meaningless without the constant stream of stimulation and distraction. Let's do a quick vote. How many of you think that's a pretty good description of the average person in New York just now? How many of you think, no, it rings false? Okay, a couple. We can talk later. You're outvoted, though. A stream inevitably subject to the laws of diminishing returns. Now, here's an interesting idea. This nullity, nothing, on the side of the subject, I'm nothing, is matched by a similar knotting in the world. For latent in this assumption is a denial of the form and beauty and integrity of the world. Hence, most citizens of the modern West, this is Hanby, live almost of necessity lives of profound fragmentation and internal contradiction. So he says there's a double nihilism here. I'm not really that interested in the world, and the world's not really that interesting. I'm not interested, I can't be compelled, and the world's not really that compelling. I'm bored, it's boring. Yes? That's what he means by that. So how to recover from this? How are we going to overcome sloth? How are we going to overcome hatred for our place, our work, our life? How are we going to have delight at the goodness offered to us and real action when life seems tiresome, just one damn thing after another. Now, as I understand the way we are now, we struggle to see reality as good. We struggle to see the world as a gift. We struggle to see each other as gifts. And we struggle to joyfully respond to the other or the world with the cry that Adam has for Eve in Genesis, at last. I've been waiting for you, at last. Nor do we tend to find our work and study as the opportunity to be and present the gift of ourselves to the world. It's just another task, somewhat intrinsically meaningless in and of itself. Or, according to the great Thomas Joseph Pieper, we struggle to see reality as good and as wonderful and as a source of joy. For Pieper, that means that the very integrity of human existence is threatened, and he has a line I love. He says, "We live in existential poverty." Like, there's never been a time in human history where wallets are so fat and thin and souls are so thin, is his point. Existential poverty. Now, it's not that we refuse to look at the world, Pieper says. In fact, we're constantly looking at the world, are we not? Constantly looking at the world. But even if we decided to really look, to attend, to pay attention, he says we would have trouble seeing, for our power of sight is impaired because we see the world as useful, not as good, not as gift. And so he says our sight needs to be restored. Seeing, he puts it, requires a basic attunement with the world. We need to tune our souls out of existential poverty into existential richness so that we can be attentive to the goodness of the world and delight in it yet again. So how? In order to accomplish that, in order to learn to delight in the world the way that a lover delights in her beloved, we're going to need a change of viewpoint. A change from the frantic desire to do and to have and to accomplish. Now, as you know, traditionally pride of place has not been given to work, but to leisure. And you'll recall, of course, in one of the grand ironies of our own experience, that the word school just means leisure. School means leisure. Your main task, if you're at the university, is leisure. Now, that seems absurd, I expect. Remember, though, leisure in the tradition doesn't simply mean downtime or entertainment or even rest. Genuine leisure, Pieper says, is not the cessation of activity. It's not stopping activity. It's engaging in activity of a certain kind and with a certain mental and spiritual attitude. The attitude is to be attuned to the real. The activity is contemplation. Now, too often, when we think of contemplation, we imagine a withdrawal from the world, and we imagine the thinker, you know, the statue, the sort of thinker. That's what we imagine contemplation is, right? Oh, the philosopher or the mystic contemplates. And generally, when we think of contemplation, we imagine a kind of navel gazing, right? Sort of like middle school journaling. I'm contemplating myself now. Who am I? What am I for? Well, that's not so great. It's true that contemplation, like philosophy or mysticism, requires attentiveness. But contemplation steps away from the hustle, not in withdrawal, and not as passivity, Pieper says, but as active receptivity, as an engagement reaching out to things with loving acceptance and affectionate affirmation. It's not a shrinking back from the world. It's not a withdrawal from the world. It's a recalibration of how we see the world. It's a making visible of what we have overlooked, which is to recognize in love the goodness of the world and to see in love. Contemplation is not passive indifference. It's not a stilling, but it's an activity of a particular intensity, a determined reaching out to the world in expectant alertness. It draws vitality from affirmation. The example of this, which is the best one, I think, is God's delight in the world after he's created it, right? Day one, it's good. Day two, it's good. Day three, it's good. This is one of the days he doesn't say which is good, but I can't remember which. And at the end, he says it's very good. He delights. Some of you will know, I'm going to misquote it, the great line from Chesterton, where Chesterton asks, why does the sun rise every day? Of course, he knows it doesn't rise. Why does the sun rise every day yet again for 13 billion years, however long the sun's been around? Some of you are like, oh, that's not how it works. But you ever placed a niece or a nephew or a younger sibling on top of the fridge and then walked away? Or just thrown them in the air? What do they do when you, so I like to do this when my kids are little. You put them on the fridge and then you, on top of the fridge and then you walk away and act like you forget that they're there. What do they do initially? Daddy, daddy, daddy. And then you come and you get them and they're all afraid. And then what do they say a second later? Again. Do it again. That's Chesterton's answer for why the sun comes up every day. God, like that child, says again. Now, who are you to countermand the judgment and aesthetic sensibility of God. If God looks at the world and its work and says, good, and good, and very good, you're bored? It's a distraction? It's pointless? It's merely a tool to some further advance? You have a hatred against the work that God has given, and against the place, and against life itself? You have sadness at the good and an aversion to embracing sadness, or embracing the good? That makes you Judge Halden. That's sloth. So we need to learn to contemplate. And in order to contemplate, Pieper says, we need to learn to feast. Because in festivity, we engage in activity for its own sake without any expectation of returns. Now, there's a lot of parties. A lot of them are quite dull, yes? You know the sort of party? You ever been to a networking party? You know, you go there with your business cards or whatever. You don't use business cards, right? You do whatever you do, right? You know how awful it is to work the room at the cocktail party and sort of introduce yourself? Hi, I'm RJ. I'm looking for a job. Do you have a job? It's just awful, is it not? And you've been to the party where you're just trying to, like, impress the other freshmen. Those are awful. Now, have you been to an actual feast? Maybe you just celebrated one. Have you been to an actual feast where you did the feast because you were giving thanks? Or have you celebrated a Sunday obligation, which is the great feast, simply because it was good to do? And our Father in heaven feeds us with spiritual food and drink out of enormous, boundless, eternal generosity. He offers us not just salve for the soul, he offers us himself. Body, blood, soul, and divinity, here I am, have communion with me, I'm your friend. All you need to do is reach out in expectant anticipation, as Pieper puts it. I'm a convert to Catholicism, and one of the reasons I converted, which is maybe not theologically best reason, but it struck my imagination, was before I was Catholic going to Mass and seeing a father take a very profoundly physically and cognitively disabled child of his in a wheelchair to receive communion. And that child was in no condition different than anyone else in the room. They were all reaching forward in expectant anticipation, begging for friendship with God, who always offers his friendship. That's a feast. So my advice to you, if you want to overcome sloth, is not to work harder, but to learn to celebrate, to learn to feast. And the best place to learn to feast is in the chapel. Because there a feast, the great Thanksgiving, is offered at all the tabernacles and all the altars of the world in an endless celebration of the goodness of receptivity. God offers himself to us. And here's a hard question. When you think about becoming existentially rich as opposed to existential poverty, is your education making you rich or poor? Judge Holden insists on his freedom. He finds everyone the object of his judgment. Nothing is worth anything in itself. Are you the judge? Are we the judge? Do we live in a time of sloth? Rather than embracing delight, do we look for comfort? Do we embrace and celebrate the goodness of being and the gifts of God, or do we find them boring and pointless and distracting? And do we cover our boredom with an endless frenzy of activity, which always has diminishing returns? So we recover by even more frenzied activity. Against that, I would suggest that you learn to contemplate, that we all learn to contemplate. And one cannot find a way to contemplate more than to do things which are worth doing for no other reason than they are worth doing, and to do those things without counting costs or counting benefits or reward, but simply embracing in eager anticipation and of endless vitality the gift that's offered to you. Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith. And it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.